from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Over the past two decades, more than 1,300 journalists around the world have been killed, and hundreds more went missing. Today, journalists face kidnappings, illegal detention, and too often murder. And the question is, what to do about it? Joel Simon, executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, has written a new book that explores some of the most difficult questions, including whether or not to negotiate with terrorists and even pay ransom. Joel Simon joins us for the hour, and we'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we're delving into a question with no easy answer. That is, how to help and protect journalists and others who are kidnapped and held hostage around the world. Already this year, three journalists have been killed in Mexico, Libya, and Ghana, and some 60 others are missing. Joel Simon is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, sometimes called Journalism's Red Cross. He spent almost two decades with that organization. His new book is titled We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom. Joel Simon, welcome to Forum.
It's great to be on.
Let me begin by just asking you to give us the big picture here. Where in the world are journalists most under threat, and how has that changed in the past 10 years, if at all?
Well, there are two sort of leading indicators of threats to journalists. One is journalists imprisoned around the world. And we've seen record high numbers of journalists imprisoned around the world. The leading jailer of journalists in the world right now is Turkey. Egypt is another country which is perennially putting journalists in prison. China is another example. In terms of violence against journalists, the threat has shifted somewhat, but that generally correlates to places where there's armed conflict. So Syria, year after year, is one of the most dangerous places. Somalia as well. But we also see high levels of violence in places like Mexico, where the threat comes not from the state or armed forces, but criminal groups that are targeting the press. So those are some of the hotspots.
And how do those two kinds of situations, whether it's a political imprisonment, a criminal kidnapping, how are those different in terms of your organization and how you think about them?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're very different. I mean, first of all, when you're dealing, they tend to be mutually exclusive. In other words, places where you see journalists imprisoned around the world, you tend not to have high levels of violence, and places where you have high levels of violence, you tend to see a weak state. So really the question is, are journalists working in an environment in which the state is the primary threat, or in which the state is too weak to protect them from the criminal and violent forces that are targeting them? So the strategy is completely different. You know, when you're engaging with the state, there's a sort of target that you can push up against, and you can try and apply pressure to get them to, you know, free journalists from prison or repeal repressive laws. When you're dealing with a non-state actor, like a criminal or a terror group, there's no sort of central locus of power. And so the kind of advocacy that you do is much more complex, and your ability to influence them is much more limited. And some of the work is really just about keeping journalists safe in those environments.
And what is generally the goal of kidnappers in places like Syria or Iraq?
Yeah, well, when I started this book, I really didn't know, you know, kidnapping is an occupational hazard for journalists. So it had been part of my work at CPJ. I've been there for 20 years. I started as a journalist in Mexico, where kidnapping is something that journalists worry about.
And just as an aside, is that mostly drug cartels?
Well, that's mostly criminals. It's mostly criminals, so it's drug cartels, but it's also just common criminals who sometimes are looking for, they're called express kidnappings. They'll put you in a taxi, you know, they'll take you to an ATM and you'll take out money. So, you know, it's just a fact of life in Mexico that this is something that everyone has to confront. But what I found when I started my research is that, you know, criminal kidnapping and kidnapping for ransom is thousands and thousands and thousands of cases around the world. No one knows the exact number, but there's a much more limited type of kidnapping that are more politically oriented, that are perpetrated by terror groups, and the goal in those instances is sometimes money, sometimes a large ransoms, which can help actually finance their operations. But it's also a coercive strategy. Sometimes it's used to influence coverage, or sometimes it's used to gain publicity for the causes that these groups espouse.
Your group focuses obviously mostly on journalists. And I'm wondering, over the last several decades, has the focus of these kinds of acts, kidnappings, murders, assassinations, changed? Because it seems like in the 70s and the 80s, it was more diplomats and
yes.
maybe politicians.
Yeah, exactly. And when I did the research into the origins of this particularly the approach in the U.S., which is this no concessions, we don't negotiate strategy. So basically, the issue emerged for the United States in the late 60s. And early 70s, when U.S. diplomats were being targeted in Latin America, and the U.S. government, you know, started carrying out research. How should they respond? There was this debate about whether they should negotiate when these kinds of kidnappings take place. And then there was a major incident that occurred in Sudan in 1973, when a group of Palestinian terrorists took over the Saudi embassy in Khartoum and kidnapped a bunch of diplomats, including two U.S. diplomats. And one of the demands was for the release of Sirhan Sirhan, the convicted killer of
Bobby Kennedy.
And President Nixon just so happened that the next day he had a press conference planned, and he was asked, you know, how do you plan to respond to this demand from this terror group? And he said, we won't negotiate, we don't pay blackmail. And these two diplomats were immediately executed. And that was actually the origins of the U.S. no concessions policy, as one of the people who was involved in studying these issues told me. It was a policy born in blood. And so that was the origins of that policy, but it then was applied across all kinds of kidnappings of Americans around the world. But that was where it started.
It seems like the government maybe learned the wrong lesson, though, in that case, that first case you described, because it obviously didn't work.
It didn't work. I mean, but I think that as I described, it was a policy born in blood. I mean, precisely because it didn't work, you know, Nixon became very personally invested in this. In some ways, it was a natural reaction. And so, you know, part of the research, and one of the people who was carrying out the research at the time actually told me that he presented his conclusion, which that there didn't seem to be any indication that not refusing to negotiate actually reduced the likelihood of kidnapping. There didn't seem to be any correlation, but the Nixon administration was quite dug in, and they didn't really want to accept these findings, and so it became entrenched. It was, you know, definitely something that President Reagan used as a sort of political talking point, even though obviously he did negotiate when Americans were taken hostages, you know, through the Bush administration. And it was actually became an official written policy for the first time at the beginning of the Clinton administration, and it remains our policy today, although there was a reassessment during the Obama administration.
Well, isn't there? I mean, there is sort of overt conversations, and then there's sort of back channel conversations in terms of negotiations. I mean, I'm thinking like with the Iran hostage situation during the Carter administration. I mean, I'd be surprised if there weren't some sort of, you know, intermediaries or something, countries that had relations with Iran, for example.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things I found in my book is the U.S. policy we don't negotiate is not consistent. The U.S. does consistently negotiate with rogue states that take what might be called judicial hostages. So there's some sort of legal process that is you know, the basis for the detention. I understand you had Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post journalist on your show, has written an amazing book about his experience. And, you know, that was an example where the U.S. found a way to engage and to eventually win his freedom. And there was an exchange, you know, I'm sure Jason talked about some of the...
Well, and just to flesh that out a little bit, so that was the time when the U.S. and other countries were negotiating with Iran over the nuclear agreement, and they used him, essentially, because he was in captivity, as leverage.
Yeah, that was what the Iranians wanted to do, and the U.S. tried to prevent them from doing that, but it was willing to release several Iranians who were in prison in the United States on sanction violations, and there were some other issues that were on the table. That where the policy applies strictly to terror groups. So the U.S. will negotiate in a lot of different circumstances where Americans are taken hostage around the world, but it will not negotiate with terror groups. It's a fairly limited number of groups. And this has come to the fore, particularly for journalists, because journalists are particularly vulnerable to these kinds of groups. They're working in conflict environments. They have to engage in order to do their job with some shadowy figures and shadowy groups, and sometimes they're betrayed and they're kidnapped, and they're kidnapped by these terror groups. And that's when this policy really becomes an impediment. You know, I first became involved in this issue because I've been involved at CPJ because, you know, going back to Daniel Pearl and some of the, you know, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and then killed in Pakistan. But this came to the fore in the summer of 2014, that when there was a whole string of kidnappings in Syria. Americans and Europeans and other Westerners were disappearing. One of them was Jim Foley, a journalist. I knew Jim. He was well known to people on our staff. And his parents were trying to figure out a way to free him. And the title of my book, We Want to Negotiate, was actually the message that his parents received from the kidnappers. But at a certain point, they realized they weren't getting the kind of help they needed from the U.S. government, and they decided they wanted to try and raise a ransom. And they came to me and they asked for my help. And I was conflicted about this for a number of reasons. One is I understood the legal consequences. This money would go to the Islamic State. And I was also worried about paying ransom could actually make it more dangerous for other journalists by because they'd be targeted. But that was that was where this question started for me, and that was the origin of the book.
And what about the concern there with Jim Foley about sort of going around the official government policy? Yeah.
Well, it was very scary. I mean, his mother, Diane, and other American families were explicitly threatened by a member of the National Security Council at a meeting that they had, where this person told them that they could be prosecuted if they paid ransom. They got other assurances from other, officials in the U.S. government. No, don't worry. No one's ever been prosecuted. But it wasn't even so much that they were concerned, because if you think about it, if you go to jail and your son is free, what do you care? But everyone who might have come forward to try and help them was intimidated, and it was a real concern that I had. And what they found was that the U.S. government under the Obama administration just really did not want to engage with them and help them figure out a way forward. And this was particularly frustrating because they saw that one after one, the European hostages were all freed.
Although ultimately some of the British hostages were killed. Well, although UK and US have that same policy.
Exactly.
Right?
The US and the UK are the leaders of this no concession camp. That's what I found. There's a stark division between the US and the UK, which occupy one corner we don't negotiate, and continental European countries which do negotiate and in some cases pay ransom.
Talking with Joel Simon, he's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He is also a former reporter in Mexico and author of the new book, We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom. And Joel, you just talked about Jim Foley's parents and the families of all these kidnapped victims. Hard to imagine what they go through. What's your experience in dealing with them?
You know, it's absolutely overwhelming. Kidnapping is just the cruelest crime, because you're in the state of perpetual limbo and powerlessness. And it can extend in the case of the ISIS hostages, one of their cruelest strategies, and I see this more frequently now, is not to communicate for an extended period of time. So the person has just disappeared. You don't know who has them. It produces this really heightened state of anxiety. When you do finally get the communication, and the confirmation, the proof of life, you're in a state of panic. But it's absolutely overwhelming. I mean, at the most basic level, contrasting, I spent a lot of time in Europe talking to families there, and this is even true in the UK. There was a basic structure of support for these families, a recognition that this was absolutely impossible, overwhelming for a family to deal with. And so they needed support from government institutions. In the U.S., at this point in time, the families just didn't have that.
What does the U.S. government or other countries, what do they tell the families to do and not do?
Well, they tell them, you know, so in the case of the Foley family, they got a young FBI agent who showed up at their house. They live in rural New Hampshire, and he was not familiar with Syria, didn't speak Arabic, didn't really know the situation, you know, and he didn't tell them much. You know, they will tell them, you know, and sometimes they'll tell them, look, the law under the Patriot Act is that you can't pay ransom, but no one's ever been prosecuted, but they can't really help them. And so they just feel completely isolated. Maybe they're monitoring. Maybe they're trying to gather, information that they could use for eventual prosecution in that unlikely event. But, you know, maybe they're, providing a little bit of guidance on how to carry out this kind of negotiation. But for the most part, families which don't have professional security advisors, which is something I also get into in the book, are really on their own.
You mentioned the Patriot Act. How did 9/11 change all of this?
Well, 9/11 changed it completely. It was a new framework. I talked about, you know, kidnapping as an occupational hazard for journalists, and I also mentioned the Daniel Pearl case. Well, the Daniel Pearl case was
the Wall Street Journal reporter
who was kidnapped while working in Pakistan not long after 9/11 and eventually beheaded. And so for journalists, that radically changed the environment, because some people don't recall that when Osama bin Laden declared jihad against the United States, he actually did it at a press conference. He engaged with the media. He invited the media to report on him. And while it was dangerous when you were in his, you know, in his sort of circle, you know, he would protect journalists. Well, when Danny Pearl was kidnapped and murdered by al-Qaeda, it sent a message to Islamist groups around the world that journalists were fair game, that they were targets, that they were no longer intermediaries. They were now targets of terror campaigns, and that murder was extremely effective because of the media visibility around his case, which I helped participate in. I helped generate that media. And I always make this point. Most people cannot name a single victim who was killed in the Twin Towers or the Pentagon. They know Danny Pearl. So that was one change. The other change was the Patriot Act and the kind of reframing of the war on terror. First of all, it empowered repressive governments around the world who justified their repressive action by claiming they were cracking down on terror. So journalists were imprisoned. And second of all, you had the Patriot Act, which, you know, prevented subsequently families and others who were trying to ransom their loved ones, you know, created this possibility of prosecution, which had not existed previously.
So it almost seems like these terror groups that kidnap journalists win either way. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, with all the publicity they got around Danny Pearl, they didn't get any money. But the alternative is they get money, they get ransom. So they really, it's a win-win in a way.
Well, I mean, I think that you have to recognize that it is a tactic of war, and it exists in every conflict, and it is effective in certain circumstances. So it will never go away, and it is a risk. You know, we've been talking about journalists, but other, particularly civilians, who are essential, who operate in conflict zones, like aid workers. It is a risk. So the question is not how can we eliminate it, which I think is sort of the framing, one of the justifications of the no concessions policy, which is that if no one ever pays ransom, nobody will ever be kidnapped. Well, I always say if nobody ever gave their wallet to a mugger, then there wouldn't be mugging. But, you know, it's a coercive strategy, and families and businesses and some governments will always pay. So kidnapping will never go away. The question is, how do we mitigate the harm? How do we reduce the amount of money that go to these terror groups when they do kidnap people? How do we reduce their ability to use these horrific murders to disseminate their own propaganda and aid recruitment? But you have to have a starting point that this is like car bombing. This is like other tactics of conflict, and it can only be managed. It cannot be eliminated.
Well, and as you say at the end of the book, it's time for a new approach. No one should have to die for a policy that isn't working. Is there any consensus around what a better policy would be?
I don't think. I mean, I think that this was when I wrote the book. This is sort of a third rail. No one is talking about this. When the Obama administration in 2015 did a review of the policy, they made a lot of improvements in terms of providing support for families, but they never put the no concessions policy on the table in terms of discussing it or modifying it. So it remains in place. And what I found, I mentioned that it doesn't seem to protect Americans from being kidnapped, there doesn't seem to be any correlation between the policy of a particular country and the rate of kidnapping. But it does dramatically reduce the survival rate. So Europeans, you know, who survive at a rate of between 75 and 100%, depending on your nationality, Americans survive at a rate of about 25%. So many, many are killed. The other justification for the policy is to prevent, you know, financing for terror groups, which is, of course, an absolutely legitimate concern from a national security perspective. We have to find ways of doing that. But I don't think this policy achieves that result either, because it creates a dynamic in which these terror groups can kill American and British hostages who have no value as a way of putting pressure on the European countries that pay and actually driving up the ransom, and so they actually get more money. So I think the way forward is for everyone to work together to reduce the amount of ransom paid and to have a much more flexible case-by-case pragmatic approach to each case.
You talk in the book a lot about France, which does negotiate and mm-hmm. does pay ransom from time to time. Does that make their journalists more unsafe?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think that, most of the French journalists I talked to said that they, you know, since this is an occupational risk, they would rather have a government who's going to stand up and defend them. And I think French people, when journalists are kidnapped, they mobilize, actually. The media mobilizes, people come into the street, and that puts political pressure on the government. The paradox of that is that all that political visibility, which puts pressure on the government, can sometimes raise the amount that they have to pay. France has a sort of very schizophrenic approach to this. The more public pressure you put on the government, the more likely they are to engage. And when they engage, that usually means paying, and they have a whole process in place to achieve this. I looked at another country, Spain, which is less conflicted and tends to just, you know, find a way to pay, and whether there's street protests or visibility, and they have 100% recovery rate. So every Spanish hostage has come home.
What's sort of an average ransom that they pay? How much?
Well, it's, you know, they're one of the things I found in my book, and there are professional negotiators, and they can tell you, they can give you a number based on, the kind of group,
profile,
the individual, et cetera. I mean, it ranges dramatically. I mean, it really, literally sometimes it's a few thousand dollars up to multi-millions of dollars. You know, it depends on the group and the situation. One of the things I found, though, is that a lot of information about ransom payments are inaccurate because there are all sorts of people who have reasons to either exaggerate the amount or minimize the amount. But I will say with some degree of certainty, there are ransoms, you know, that are north of $10 million. Have been paid.
And when you think about all the ways in which these terror groups get their funding, how important is ransom?
It depends. You know, one of the things that I found is that, when there was this whole debate with the Islamic State hostages in the summer of 2014, you know, there was a lot of concern and legitimate concern that ransom payments would be used to continue to finance their terror activities. But remember that they had, you know, taken over the bank in Mosul in Iraq. They'd sacked the bank. They had access to the oil fields in northern Syria. They were extorting the population. So they had huge influxes of income. It was significant, but it was not determinative.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation with Joel Simon. His book is titled We Want to Negotiate: The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org or tweet us at us if you'd like. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And our guest this hour is Joel Simon. He's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. His book is called We Want to Negotiate: The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom. We'd love to hear from you. Give us your thoughts about U.S. policy. Should we negotiate? Should we not? Pay ransom? No? Yes? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Would love to hear from some journalists, perhaps, who've worked overseas and what their experiences have been, particularly in some of these war-torn areas. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And I should mention, Joel, you're going to be at the World Affairs Auditorium in San Francisco tonight at 6:30.
Yep.
All right. We're going to go to the calls in a second, but I want to ask you a question. We We're talking about Danny Pearl earlier and that horrific beheading and the video, which I couldn't watch,
I never watched it.
But talk about the rise of social media and cell phones and how that's changed this conversation.
Completely. Well, first of all, it's changed the dynamic for journalists because as someone who, you know, was a journalist working in, you know, somewhat risky environments, you know, and I had some close scrapes. And, you know, one of the arguments you would always make, look, is if you kidnap me or harm me in any way, no one's going to cover your story. No journalists are going to come. And, you know, I'm going to write a story about what's happening here. And I'm going to be fair. So let me go and do my job. And you had some weight when you made that argument because they didn't have other ways of communicating. They were really relying on journalists to mediate whatever they wanted the public to know. Now, criminal groups in Mexico, like the drug cartels, use social media, and certainly jihadi groups and Islamist groups have very sophisticated media operations. And this began with Al Qaeda, but it was obviously taken to a completely different level by the Islamic State. So journalists themselves are much more vulnerable because that argument of "don't kill me" because who's going to tell your story? That's been removed. Secondly, the value of these terrorizing videos is so tremendous. I talked about how Al-Qaeda, you know, managed to kill one person, a journalist, and send this terrorizing message to millions around the world because that murder was amplified by the media itself. But the Islamic State, when they carried out these ritualized murders, which, of course, were not just journalists. There were many, many people killed in these public executions. You know, they were able to disseminate that, terrorizing local populations, sending a message of you know, that they were fearsome. And also they used it for recruitment. This is one of the things I found out, you know, that they were basically able to, you know, they would post these terrorizing videos, and if somebody engaged with them and said, you know, glad you're doing this, they would reach out to them and try and bring them into the fold. So these social media has become a critical tool of these Islamist groups, and these videos are very powerful. So I would argue that we have a national security imperative of trying to deny these groups victims.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number to call if you want to talk with Joel Simon is 866-733-6786. And we'll begin with Joe in San Francisco. Welcome.
Yeah, I was calling. I was curious to find out how, once a ransom amount is agreed upon, how does that money transfer actually go through? Is it through banks or what's a typical procedure?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, well, I talked to a number of security consultants who'd been involved in transfers, and you know, it varies. Every case is different, and they have different strategies. But you know, it's usually cash that's put into a duffel bag and, you know, handed off somewhere, or in some cases dropped from an airplane. And so there's something I write about in my book called Kidnapping and Ransom Insurance. And if you have this insurance, which sounds very strange but is pretty commonplace among high-risk groups that work in these areas, then you will get a professional security negotiator, a kidnapping negotiator, if you're kidnapped, and they are experts at exchanging money. And each circumstance is different, but you know, basically, it's handed off in cash, sometimes through airdrops and sometimes through intermediaries.
And what are they negotiating exactly? The amount?
Yeah, they're negotiating.
So they're not negotiating their freedom. I guess it's sort of the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, these are kidnappings. And, you know, one of the things that this framework helps do is turn kidnapping into an economic crime and make the demands financial, which of course is difficult, as that is, you know, families and businesses can come up with money. When the demands are political, you know, and it's release this person and take these political actions, you know, that inevitably involves the government. So I think that we're better off, as difficult as that is, trying to sometimes this is called privatize the negotiation. So I do think that governments need to be involved and supportive, but it's actually better if they're in the background.
To what extent do they use those money drops or even the negotiations to find the victim and to find the kidnappers?
Yes, well, that's another reason why negotiating is so crucial. And I talked to, you know, European intelligence people worked in intelligence, and, you know, they use the negotiation to identify the kidnappers. Sometimes they can go after them. There have been cases where they've been arrested or lured. Somali kidnappers, there's a famous case in Canada, was lured back to Canada, then arrested. So the intelligence gathered through these negotiations is critical.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 866-733-6786. And Kim, you're on with Jill Simon. And you're calling, well, I think, from Mumbai.
Yes, Mumbai, India. And I live in San Francisco, in the Sunset District, but I'm right now traveling internationally. I'm a journalist. I write for Asia News. And I've been involved in quite a few hostage situations in Mumbai, in India, and also in Afghanistan. But the comments I wanted to make was about U.S. foreign policy, it doesn't matter whether it's the current administration or the past, endangers the lives of U.S. citizens like myself when we travel. You know, so I'm not in favor of the government paying ransom because it just encourages the hostage takers to do it again. But the point I wanted to make was that U.S. foreign policy, whether it's about Afghanistan or Middle East or whatever, it just endangers our own citizens. And that is where the culpability lies with the U.S. government. And, you know, so I'm not saying I absolve the hostage takers of their responsibility, but U.S. citizens are always in the cross range of internationally.
Yeah, let's give Joel a chance.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things I found is that I think that is an important variable. I mean, one of the ISIS hostages I talked to, a Spanish hostage, said, you know, what matters most, whether, you know, you live or die in these situations, is not your hostage policy, but your foreign policy. So there are definitely a lot of groups that, you know, are very hostile to the United States. And if you're an American, you're more vulnerable. And the U.S. is engaged militarily around the world. And so U.S. citizens become a target. But the counter argument to that is Italians get kidnapped, Germans get kidnapped, Swiss get kidnapped, people from countries which have different foreign policies and are not directly engaged are also targeted. So I think it's a key variable. I think it's a factor. American journalists, you know, because of they're perceived as representing, and they obviously don't. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, that you prize as a journalist is your independence. But there are certain circumstances where it's hard to convince people that you have an independent position and role.
Kim, I'm curious. You're in India, and Joel, in your book, you mentioned India as one of the countries that imprisons a lot of journalists. People don't really think of that happening in India so much, more Turkey and, you know, China perhaps.
Well, India, the problem in India is the increasing problem is more violence. And particularly, and there actually was a murder of a journalist in Mumbai carried out by a criminal group there. But you know, basically, India is a place where you have a very dynamic and well-funded and well-resourced media, you know, that based in the larger cities. But once you get out into the larger cities, into the hinterlands, you know, the press is extremely vulnerable, and their Maoist groups and criminal groups and journalists are at the mercy of these groups, and the government has not been able to protect them or effectively investigate these crimes.
Kim, I'm curious, what experience have you had as a journalist there?
I just had a comment to make about this statement he made. I agree there is violence against Indian journalists, but even the Indian government, like the Turkish government and the Chinese government, has been imprisoning Indian journalists. There were several instances where just a comment on Twitter against the current Prime Minister Modi got the journalist arrested. You know, and that is a very insidious fact which most foreigners are not aware of.
Yeah.
I agree. If you go to Chhattisgarh and other areas where there are Naxalites that are Maoist sympathizers, you know, they do kidnap journalists.
Yeah.
But the journalists as a body across India, we are more concerned about the government, oppressing free speech. Yeah.
All right. Kim, I'm gonna have to move along, but I really do appreciate your call and your perspective from India. Thanks so much for joining us on that. You know, some people hearing stories like, you know, Kim's and obviously others who have been killed, Jim Foley and many others, why do journalists want to put themselves in this situation? What is it? What drives war correspondents to be where they are?
Well, I think there's a wide variety of factors. I mean, I think that journalists are motivated by a certain public service view of the work that they do, that if they're able to cover conflict and report on conflict, you know, they're saving lives. They're making people aware of the suffering. They're making the public aware of the, you know, complexities that are essential to conflict resolution and public understanding and the formulation of policy. So you're serving a larger purpose. At the same time, it's an incredibly exciting experience. I mean, part of the danger is part of the appeal. You know, it's a weird kind of mix of kind of high-mindedness and ego that drives, war correspondence. And I think I think we have to recognize both parts of this. I don't think we should minimize, the excitement and the kind of personal validation that comes with doing this kind of work. It is an important motivator, but I think we also have to appreciate, and this is something that is in short supply, honestly. You know, the kind of detailed, nuanced, on the ground, informed coverage of conflicts that actually helps inform policymaking and public engagement. You know, we're seeing, the collapse of Venezuela right now. We're seeing potential pullout in Afghanistan. We're seeing, a rapid pullout in Syria. What are the consequences of these actions? You know, we need journalists on the ground to help explain these things and help us understand them.
All right, let's go now to Matthew in Dublin. Is that Dublin in the East Bay or Ireland?
East Bay.
Okay, less exotic. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm an independent voter, and I always say, even though I don't agree with Trump, at least I know what he stands for, whereas President Obama was doing things very quietly behind the scenes. And one of those things was he was using the Espionage Act to lock up journalists. Some of those included Thomas Drake, Shammai Leibowitz, Stephen Kim, and many others. And I would love to hear the journalists' thoughts or interpretation of the situation. Was Obama justified in doing that? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Joel.
Yeah, I mean, I have a slightly different perspective, but I fundamentally agree that, the Obama administration had policies that were frankly damaging to press freedom and in this country, and one of them was a kind of vision of the threats from leaks, and so they had a very aggressive policy of investigating leaks, and they used this frankly archaic legal framework, the 1917 Espionage Act, which basically criminalizes the dissemination of confidential information, and a number of leakers were prosecuted under this law, and journalists were ensnared in those investigations. They were subpoenaed, I think that it's at a very dangerous precedent. And the reason these precedents are important is because the same framework is continuing under the Trump administration.
Well, talk about President Trump, because he has famously been hostile to the media. Any reporter who's covered one of his events knows he often calls out journalists and has called them, I think, enemies of the people and enemies of the country. But at the same time, I think you mentioned in the book that he's very takes these things very personally, gets very personally, follows them very carefully.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, Trump has been engaged on the issue of U.S. hostages, and that's positive. I think that, while Obama was sort of hamstrung to a certain extent by the national security implications of these issues and sometimes lost track of the humanitarian considerations, Trump is the opposite. He sees the political benefit, but is indifferent to the strategic complexities and has gutted the State Department and gutted the informed understanding he would need to actually make, rational decisions. But I want to make a broader point. We have a blog posted on our website today, cpj.org, that I would highly recommend that analyzes Trump's history of tweeting and has a lot of data. And what we found is that, you know, Trump has sort of moved from attacks on individual journalists. He moved to this fake news framework that started after he became president and enemies of the people. His latest framework for attacking journalists is calling them the opposition. And it's all very dangerous. It's dangerous. I don't think it inhibits individual journalists. I think that we're seeing a lot of great reporting, but it undermines public confidence in the media. And it has a terrible, and the other thing that concerns me is it inspires people online who are threatening and even, you know, sending letter bombs to journalists. But more importantly, I think, is this empowers autocrats around the world. This fake news framing is a gift to autocratic leaders. And, you know, in the Philippines, for example, President Duterte there is calling critical journalists, you know, fake news. There's actually, you know, trying to get a fake news law on the books there. Basically, the argument there is, well, you just talk about fake news, but I'm doing something about it. If, you know, I'm going to put journalists in jail who publish news that I deem to be fake. So it's having terrible consequences around the world in terms of strengthening the repressive leaders and providing them with a new framework to justify crackdowns on the media.
I want to ask you about the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi,
yeah.
Who was murdered, of course, in the Saudi consulate, yeah, in Istanbul.
Yeah.
Your group, I believe, is suing the United,
yes,
States for records.
Right.
Talk about that case.
Yeah, so we're working with the Knight Center of Columbia. We recently joined a lawsuit. Basically, under U.S. law, the U.S. government has what's called a duty to warn. So if a U.S. person is there's a threat against a U.S. person that the intelligence services become aware of, they have to let them know. And we believe, based on circumstantial evidence, that there was an awareness within the intelligence community of the threat to Jamal Khashoggi. This includes alleged reports of text messages exchanged between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, prior to Jamal Khashoggi's visit to the consulate in Istanbul, where he was subsequently murdered and dismembered. So there's some evidence that there was an awareness that he was at risk and he was not warned. So we filed potentially suing the U.S. government to compel them to make public this information to answer the question of whether they complied with this legal requirement.
How likely is it you think that they will comply?
I'm a journalist. I'm not a lawyer, so I'll leave it to the lawyers to answer that question. I mean, I think we have a strong case, but I think that really, you know, one of the reasons you file a lawsuit like this is, you know, you hope to win, but you also want to make the point. And so, whether we win or not, I think it's important that we express our concern in this way. You know, one thing I want to mention about the Khashoggi case, a sort of interesting development, is the UN special rapporteur on forced disappearances is actually, her name is Agnes Callamard, and she is actually in Istanbul now, carrying out an investigation into the crime. So that's good that there continues to be international attention, and we're hoping ultimately that the UN Secretary General gets behind an international investigation. There are not that many clear paths to justice, but that's a critical step.
Got some listener comments here. Richard writes, sad, but isn't this also the problem of being a citizen of a world superpower? Your guest talks about other countries, but those countries are countries which do not have the same geopolitical position.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a case to be made. I mean, I think that part of it is, and I think we discussed this with Kim, who called in from India, you know, the U.S., you know, sort of geopolitical posture in the world creates complexities. But again, if you look at the data and you look at who's kidnapped, you realize just how complex this crime is. You know, Turkish citizens are kidnapped and, people from Latin America. And of course, most of the kidnappings are domestic. So, you know, international kidnapping is a relatively small set of the overall number, but you know it is a very complex crime, and motivations are always variable, which is why I think it's really critical that we not get locked into a narrow policy framework, but have the broadest and most flexible policy possible.
Another comment here: a listener asks, "Can you speak to hostage exchanges? Is it a good policy for the United States to be in the business of using humans in exchange for other people?"
Well, this is a nasty business, sometimes I kind of at the end of the book, I look at, you know, how do we look at this issue? Is it an ethical issue? Is it a political issue? Is it a policy issue? And the ethics of, you know, ransom payments and exchanges, you know, it's a coercive strategy. So the goal of the kidnappers is to compel people to do things that are contrary to their values and principles. So, you know, you always have to kind of look at it from that perspective. But I will say that prisoner exchanges under the Geneva Conventions are specifically contemplated, and that the U.S. does engage in prisoner exchanges when their service personnel are taken captive in the context of an armed conflict. And people may remember the Bo Bergdahl case. The soldier who wandered off the base in Afghanistan was taken hostage by the Taliban, and the U.S. released five prisoners from Guantanamo for his freedom. And I should point out that if he were a journalist or an aid worker, there would have been no negotiation. The Taliban is a designated terror group, so there would have been no negotiation. It's only because he was a service member that there was.
Although they later court-martialed him, I believe.
Well, yeah. I mean, the question is not whether he deserves to be punished.
Yeah.
The question is,
what is the policy?
How do we engage when these terrible things happen?
You're listening to Forum. Joel Simon from the Committee to Protect Journalists is appearing tonight at the World Affairs Council, tonight at 6:30. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And let's go back to the phones now. Timothy, you're next. Welcome.
Yes, Mr. Simon, mentioning the 43 missing in Mexico makes people think of the alleged story of Mossad right after 9/11 attacking the Congress in Mexico. That was just very much hushed up. There, some people have said there's a lot of Mossad activity in Mexico, and that the 43 and many journalists in Mexico were tracked using the Mossad software, Pegasus. Could you comment on that? And also in D.C., the investigative journalist who mysteriously died, Jen, J-E-N, Moore, who is investigating Clinton sex crimes.
Joel Simon, are you aware of that one?
No, I'm not aware of that one. I don't want to comment on it because I'm not aware of it. But I will talk about the point that I certainly can talk about is the Pegasus software. So basically, this is a software developed by an Israeli security firm that, when it's implanted on your phone, basically takes over your phone. And we know that the Mexican government purchased the software and used it to try and in some cases successfully compromise the communication of journalists and other activists. And it's a very powerful tool. But I would commend to readers a new story today from Reuters about a new program that was it's an important story that was happening in the United Arab Emirates that involved former U.S. NSA employees who were working for the Emirati government using new software that actually all you needed was the phone number. The thing about this Pegasus software is you needed to click on a link. With this new software, which is this is a new development, if they just have your phone number, they can basically take over your phone. And so everyone is vulnerable, journalists particularly. And there was an example in the story that was published today by Reuters of a British journalist who was a target. But, you know, phones are increasingly insecure. They're finding new backdoors every day. It's a big concern for our organization, for journalists, and for other vulnerable populations who rely on these devices to communicate.
Are Apple and other phone makers, are they working to sort of interfere with that kind of software?
Well, I mean, I think when they become aware of it, I mean, these are very, very sophisticated technologies that are developed by governments for the precise purpose of of espionage. So, you know, it's a cat and mouse, but I always assume that my phone's not secure and that I try and engage in best practice. I worry a lot about this, but at the end of the day, I don't have complete confidence that I can secure the information on my phone, and I believe that most journalists doing high-risk kinds of work share these concerns.
And Dan Zoll, our producer, puts up a headline from the New York Times today. It reads, Apple was slow to act on FaceTime bug that allows spying on iPhones, which is another example.
That was not developed by some spy agency. that was detected by some teenager.
Seven-year-old,
whose mom tried to alert Apple that...
There was a problem.
There was a problem, and they were very slow to act. So imagine how they react when there's a kind of backdoor created by a government intelligence agency.
All right, let's try to sneak one more call in. Dan in Santa Clara, you're next.
Good morning. I have a larger question. Maybe you could help me with.
Okay.
Whether there's a correlation between the lack of standing in the American public mind and the media in general. And
I'm going to ask you to be quick because we're coming up at the end of the hour.
I'm sorry, and the ease with which journalists are targeted around the world, and to what degree the media is to blame, particularly cable news, by becoming infotainment, which happened long before Trump and all those guys started attacking it.
Yeah, thank you, Joel.
I think it's I'm going to put that into a global perspective because that's my job, and what I will say is this: if you look at places like Venezuela, if you look at places like Turkey, if you look at places like Russia, when the media is perceived as a political actor, they are much more vulnerable to systematic government repression. So, when you have a free media. When you don't have the government controlling the media and you have other forces determining what the media does, and there's lots of reasons to be critical, and I'm not suggesting that the government should somehow intervene and regulate the media, but I will say that media performance, in my experience, correlates with greater repression because the public has to feel they have a stake in the press freedom battle, and if they don't, then the media is more vulnerable.
All right. Joel Simon, his new book is called We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom. He's appearing tonight at 6:30 at the World Affairs Council. Thanks so much for coming in. And very important topic. Thanks for bringing it to light.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening, for participating with your calls and your emails. We'll be back.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.